Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So all these systems of domination, the military-industrial complex, etc., all of these complexes, the educational-industrial complex, the legal-industrial complex, how are all these complexes intertwined in how has the globalization of capitalism become fundamental? Because, for instance, we know that slavery and capitalism go hand in hand. You can't have capitalism without slavery.
That's the voice of renowned author Peter McLaren, and this week's show we speak to Peter about decolonizing the educational system and the struggles of naming the system in academia. So stay tuned.
Someone who has been speaking about not just making visible inequality, but also teaching against the global capitalism and the new imperialism and critical pedagogy. Peter McLaren wrote this amazing book with Raman Farmanpour, and I'm very privileged to have him on our program. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. McLaren.
My pleasure.
Now, you know, in the old ways of empire, ships used to go to lands far away, inhabited by millions of indigenous people for thousands of years. And the discovery process usually consisted of the process of genocide, forced displacement, and slavery of original peoples throughout the continents. The story of empire is told as if this is an artifact of the past, you know, a distant past. But imperialism did not go away. And in your book, you make it very clear that it is always been here, perhaps now in more sophisticated ways of subjection and theft. Can you talk a little bit about the way that the academy and education has contributed to the invisibility of imperialism within our system of education?
You know, it's really interesting and quite shocking. What we're looking at, all kinds of forms of imperialism and domination. We can talk about economic imperialism. We can talk about, you know, forms of imperialism and colonization that existed, you know, during the days of the conquest, so-called conquest in 1492. And we can find similarities, of course. And there are areas in Latin America among indigenous peoples that are still experiencing forms of colonization that they experienced, you know, hundreds of years ago. So it's not something that has disappeared at all. But I think you're referring to, Sylvia, the notion of, you know, globalization of capitalism. And that's a form of imperialism. And that's a form of imperialism that's been with us for a long time. And we can talk maybe a little bit about how different that might be in the context of earlier forms of imperialism. But I think the general point, because I think we're trying to connect this to education, is to connect the dots between the globalization of capitalism today, or capitalist or neoliberal globalization, and the production of inequality. And so my argument, basically, is that we need, for educational reform to take root, serious educational reform, in order for that to take root, we need to eliminate poverty. That should be our goal as much as creating equality of access through education. Now, when I say that, when I go and I give talks and make that point, rightly so, people will respond to me and say, you know, you can't use poverty as an excuse for the failing schools or poor teaching. And I would say, well, that's true. But in the current reform debates, when you say poverty isn't an excuse, this has become an excuse for ignoring poverty. So saying poverty isn't an excuse has actually become an excuse for ignoring poverty. So, yes, we can't look at poverty as an excuse, but we also can't ignore poverty. So that the elimination of poverty should be a goal as much as creating a quality of access to education. Now, you might say, isn't educational reform the best way to create job opportunities for the poor? Well, I would argue, as an educator, that sure, access to education is important, and surely it's tragic, for instance, that education in many communities is the only way to survive. And of course, education matters more today. Well, I would argue that it matters more today than ever before. But it matters more in terms of making the quality of the lives of students more equal. So, you know, I think we have to make a distinction between schooling and school reforms in making the quality of lives of students more equal and reducing inequality, so that schools, you know, I would argue, have a fairly minimal potential to reduce overall economic inequality. So I think we need to attack inequality through more direct political policies.
Well, this is important because when we talk about the gap between rich and poor, the answer from academic circles is usually, well, we need more literacy. People need to have more literacy. And I think that's good. However, it matters what we teach. It matters how and who is teaching, how we conceive education. You know, to those of us who imagine education as the possibility to expand our creative capacity versus those who conceive education simply as the institution that helps us become malleable subjects to create capital. So I wonder if you could start there, you know, the constitutive role that capitalism has in the education system when we see the children simply as future workers or as educating to become part of that production of capital. Is there something else we as teachers need to take into account, or how do we reclaim, reappropriate education so that it is much more than that? It speaks to our own humanity, the expansion of our creative potential.
I think that's really important. I just wanted to make the distinction between, you know, what education can possibly do to create less inequality and what we really need in terms of abolishing inequality, which is basically, you know, the struggle for a socialist alternative to capitalism. Now, so I just wanted to make, you know, those are like two areas that we need to really focus on, how to make schooling something more than simply, you know, reproducing a capitalist workforce, et cetera, et cetera. That's an important battle. But I also wanted to talk a little bit, if I could, about how to basically eliminate inequality and what the factor of inequality does and how it affects children in our schools. Because there's a study that was done, I think he's a Canadian professor. His name, I think, is Douglas Wilms. And he found that among children whose parents have identical levels of education, those children who lived in unequal countries performed worse, for instance, on tests of adult literacy. So, for instance, children of parents with college degrees in general perform the same, you know, whether they live in Finland, which is one of the most equal countries, or the U.S., which is one of the most unequal. But children in the U.S. whose parents only attained, for instance, a high school diploma, will in general perform worse on literacy tests than children in Finland whose parents only attained high school degrees. And this is because economic inequality affects the quality of family life, in areas, for instance, of health, security, substance abuse, etc. So, yes, we need educational reforms, but we need to reduce inequality and poverty just as much if we want to increase the quality of educational opportunity. Now, turning to the flip side of this, well, what can we do to increase the quality of education for for our students, for our young people. Well, we have now, of course, the push for corporate education reform. This is a disaster, and we all know this. People like Jonathan Kozol and Stan Karp and others have written about this. The proposals for corporate educational reform today, we all know what they are: increased test-based evaluation of students, the elimination of tenure for high school students, the elimination of seniority rights, an end to pay for experience. You know, teachers are no longer getting paid for having advanced degrees. We're closing low-performing schools. They're being replaced now by publicly funded but privately run charter schools. We got now the local school boards, which used to have some governance, you know, power. Now they're being replaced with, you know, mayors and state takeovers, or they're being managed by private companies. We've got vouchers and tax credit subsidies for private school tuition. We've got increases in class size. And sometimes class size is tied to the firing of 5 to 10% of the teaching staff. So a lot of people who are looking at the question of class size today fail to connect it to firing 10%, for instance, of the teaching staff, so that we've got, you know, all this focus on Common Core standards as a standard for high school graduation. So all of these proposals that people, school reformers have written about, are being promoted by all these foundation reports, all these right-wing think tanks. And I'm thinking, for instance, of the right-wing American Legislative Exchange Council, which is very powerful, and it's kind of a collection of private, you know, corporate heads and public, you know, educators. And they're trying to increase this link between private enterprise in public education. Sylvie, it's been an absolute disaster for schools. It's been an absolute disaster. And so you know, I think that we need to look at this in a two-pronged way. And one is, what can we do to increase the quality of life for young people and students so that they can become critical thinkers and challenge the globalization of capitalism? That's number one. And secondly, outside of the whole arena of school reform, we have to work for the abolition of poverty. And I think the only way we can fight that battle is to abolish the globalization of capitalism itself. Does that make sense?
I wanted to pick on that because that, I think, is central to any discussion we must have about education. And that is, education, you know, if it's going to be a practical tool of liberation as envisioned by Paulo Freire, we need to ask, well, how do we create this interconnected practice that allow us and invites us to not only propose solutions to the problems we face, like you point out, mass poverty, abject poverty among many people, the increasing hunger and the multiple deaths that happen daily due to, hunger-related diseases. So what does a revolutionary critical pedagogy that is intent on eradicating inequality look like? What would that look like, and how do teachers engage?
Well, it's an interesting question. Again, I think revolutionary critical pedagogy is an approach. You mentioned Paulo Freire. I've tried to build upon his work. Other people that have written about this that have done made extraordinary contributions would be Henry Giroux, Donaldo Macedo, and many, many others. So they have, obviously been mentors of mine throughout the years. Paulo Freire, you mentioned, has just been banned. His book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is a key, absolute key and foundational book for all critical educators, has been banned recently in the Tucson public school system. It was being used in their ethnic studies course in high school there, and it was being used with books like Rudy Acuna's Occupied America, and those books have been essentially banned. You can still, you know, go to the library and find them in the library in Tucson, I guess. I don't know. I suppose they're there. But you can't read them if you're a high school student in the ethnic studies program, not just because they've been banned, but because the ethnic studies program itself has been abolished. And so you've, in the U.S. in particular, you have an attack, an indirect attack on critical pedagogy, critical approaches to thinking, learning, and acting. Now, critical pedagogy basically makes attempts to make available. It doesn't try to sell or propagandize. It doesn't try to sort of sell you, you know, one political viewpoint about the world. It tries, however, to bring in conversations, discourses, texts, readings, and experiences that open students up to alternative and, in many cases, oppositional viewpoints that students normally don't get in their high school or elementary school experiences. So, for instance, it opens up the possibilities for rigorous debates around issues that affect all of us. Questions related to religion, to economics, to globalization, to imperialism. And it teaches, or it opens up the possibilities. I see, I don't think, you can't teach anybody anything. You can only create opportunities for people to learn. And the question is, how do we open up these spaces in our schools for critical thinking about issues that are affecting all of our lives without being authoritarian? So critical educators will speak with a certain amount of authority on issues and try to do this in a way that's non-authoritarian. So, you know, in ways that don't silence other people's voices. I mean, I, you know, in my university classes at UCLA or now in University of Auckland in New Zealand, I would welcome, voices to challenge me. I love it when conservative students will come in, even reactionary students, and take my classes, because what we do is we open up their voice and we take seriously their arguments and we enter into a very detailed, critical, strenuous, rigorous debate on those issues. And that's what schooling should be. Now, what's happened now in schools is those debates have been shut down. If you begin to critique, you know, capitalism, or if you launch into a critique of imperialism or white supremacy, you're called a racist, basically. So everything has kind of reversed itself now. So that if, for instance, I wanted to offer a course in a high school or university or community college on, you know, a critique of whiteness or white privilege, right? That would be shut down completely. That's where we've arrived in the U.S. scene. So there's really, this is sold on public education. To replace it with private charter schools, many of them religious, is really, in many ways, an attack on critical thinking and critical pedagogy. So it's an attack on one of the few public spaces that are available now that haven't been colonized completely by globalized capitalism. Those spaces, which are public schools and universities, are now under massive assault.
Well, that's important, because while we recognize that the crisis we face today is not just an economic crisis, but capitalism itself, I mean, the crisis has been ongoing, you know, from the 1920s collapse in the financial system. It has been ongoing. The minute you give the banks unfettered access and continues, to operate without regulation, you're going to have these problems. Capital seeks only its own reproduction. It doesn't care about the economic or ecological disasters that it's causing. So what would an anti-capitalist pedagogy, a decolonizing pedagogy look like? And why is it that we can't talk about that today? Why is it that in a society that claims to be enlightening and talks about critical pedagogy, we really don't have any critical analysis of the capitalist system itself?
Well, we don't. You know, it's really interesting. I mean, this is really the powerful question. I mean, I proposed, for instance, in my department at UCLA, which is very progressive, and I think that they're doing incredible work in the UCLA School of Education, but I proposed a few years ago, for instance, in our urban schooling program, I was in a department of urban schooling, right? And so we're all urban schooling specialists, right? So I said, one of the key questions that we need to explore in all of our courses is, how does capitalism itself introduce limitations to the possibility of urban educational reform? In other words, you know, within capitalist societies, there's only so much wiggle room we're given to create urban school reform initiatives. So how does capitalism constrain us? And the very enlightened faculty there, who are terrific and some of the best educators, I think, educational researchers in the United States, some of them looked at me and said, hey, Peter, that's a good question for your critical pedagogy course, but we don't think it's an appropriate question to ask our students in general. So even among very enlightened and, in many cases, you know, very progressive educators, they're not willing to sort of put capitalism up for scrutiny. And if they do, it's basically like this. How can we make capitalism a little bit more friendly? How can we take resources created by capitalism and move them around a little bit so that, you know, poor people get, you know, a larger portion of the pie? So they talk about the redistribution of resources. Well, of course, I'm all for that, but that's certainly not going to address the significant problems that we're facing now. We have to put capitalism itself under scrutiny, and that's part of the decolonial process, is linking capitalism to other systems of domination. So, you know, and there's a group now, a group of educational researchers that are writing about decolonizing education, decolonizing pedagogy. Natalia Jaramillo, of course, is prominent in this area, but we have people like Ramon Grosfogual at Berkeley. He's in ethnic studies. We have Enrique Dussel from Mexico. We've got Anibal Quijano from Peru. We have Catherine Walsh from Ecuador. So we have theorists now who are making a very important link between capitalism and the birth of neoliberal globalization, specifically neoliberalism today, which one can trace through Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and their attack on unions, in Reagan's case, the attack on air traffic controllers, in Thatcher's case, the smashing of the miner strike. We can trace this to the assault on labor unions now. But in the U.S., for instance, in the 1950s, I think over 33% of private sector was unionized. And now I think it's less than, 7%? I don't know exactly, but it's paltry in creation to what it was. I think fewer than 7% of private sector workers have a union behind them today. So the idea of decolonial pedagogy is to make these connections. How is the globalization of capitalism, how is it connected to issues of, you know, the domination, spiritual domination by Christianity, racial domination in terms of, you know, what kind of jobs were available to Europeans in Latin America, or, you know, versus indigenous groups, you know, spiritual domination of Christianity over indigenous belief systems. how, you know, the legal systems that went into place, for instance, in Latin America, linking all of these together and finding that they're mutually constitutive. In other words, they actually help bolster each other. They're very interconnected. They're very entangled. So all these systems of domination, the military-industrial complex, etc., all of these complexes, the educational-industrial complex, the legal-industrial complex, how are all these complexes intertwined, and how has the globalization of capitalism become fundamental? Because, for instance, we know that slavery and capitalism go hand in hand. You can't have capitalism without slavery. And we could make an argument about wage slavery today, and I think we can make that argument hold. So it's, I think, providing people with an opportunity of making these links. Now, you know, it's interesting, the Occupy Wall Street movements, I would say most of the analysis coming out around the Occupy Wall Street movement, you know, basically said, well, capitalism's bad, let's reform it, let's reform the banking sector, or let's reform this sector, that sector. And that's important for people to see. But now you're finding some people from that movement are even going further, and they're looking at capitalism as a whole. So I think the kind of trend among the left today, the progressive left, is to see the problems that we're facing now in schools and in society at large as really just a problem with the banking sector or greedy, you know, corporate CEOs whose greed has brought us all down. But I think more critical minds are looking to the whole system of capitalism itself.
We've come to the end of our show, Peter, and I just want to thank you so much for being with us today. I think that the questions you raised are very important and integral to transform not just education, but a society as a whole.
Right. I think that's really the point. Absolutely the point. We need to ask those questions, and we need to ask them now because I think time's running out.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.